Dreams have been deemed sacred by humans for thousands of years. They are seen by many as that of prophecy and forethought of what is to come. But what happens when we cannot question the dreams which we receive? When we take them for face value and allow them to be seen as final truth? Perhaps this deep from which the dream comes is actually God, but even then, we still find ourselves seeking permission to question this unknown source of the so-called Almighty. Rather than succumbing to the dream of bowing before God, are we instead meant to interpret and examine the deep so as to understand what these messages mean? Are we in fact required to find out how the beyond relates to ourselves and our own lives, so as to apply these meanings as an aid to everyday existence? This is the central issue facing Paul Atreides in Dune Part 1. His dreams and visions are given to him and seem so real, so true, that at times he feels he has no other choice but to listen and follow. And as the visions become more pronounced and vivid, Paul finds it more difficult to question the path that is being carved out for him, whilst losing the ability to find a way that is not inevitably fated to occur. The opening of the film provides a brief glimpse into this potential dark timeline of Paul's, as Chani tells of the Harkonnen exit from Arrakis. This change of guard brings the potentiality of new oppressors and the sense that a fresh tyrant is bound to arise. The first image following this narration is of Paul, providing a foreboding sign that he will be the one who eventually rises and suppresses the desert people. He will be the one who rules over all, unless he can learn to question his dreamed destiny. Paul is seen at breakfast with his mother, and they speak about the upcoming events involving their family's royal orders. He says to her,
"Why do we have to go through all this when it's already been decided?"
With his mother simply replying,
"Ceremony?"
In this brief exchange, Paul's oncoming struggles with prescience and future visions are summed up. For him, it may seem like a ceremony, or better yet, a formality, to go through the coming events of the desert, even though it seems like his fate has already been decided. Why should he try to make decisions if the future is already known? Perhaps he is only living to enact the ceremony, to go through the motions. But a formal life is one that is not engaged with being. Instead, it is a facade and sham of what true existence is. Paul still has the ability to contemplate at this stage, despite the fact that his upbringing and conditioning have demanded that he not question what is ordained to happen. He is being asked to accept the ceremony of his existence, to go along with the decrees of the gods, though he still possesses the strength to consider other available options. The Duke speaks privately with Paul about their current political situation, and he expresses intent to gain more power by merging with the people of the Fremen. The Lord and their house are looking for ultimate strength against all their opposition. Meanwhile, Paul is still unsure if he wants to become Duke in the future, and his father tells him that he may choose his own path in life. But these words are hollow shells, and the psychic influence on Paul will prove to be a much stronger force in his decision-making. The statements mean nothing in comparison to what has been baked into his genes and his very essence. If all past generations have taken the route of inheriting this destiny, of becoming the next Duke in line to rule, then how is Paul to break out and become something different? His attempts at questioning his place in the Order and philosophizing about the nature of the world can help his attempts to find a new way, but these factors may pale in comparison to the mountain of evidence pointing him towards a dictator-type role. He has been physically and mentally trained by everyone in his life to become a certain type of thing, to become the one who connects space and time and to save humankind.
The Reverend Mother Geiselim Ohaim is here. She was my teacher at the Bene Gesserit school. She's now truthsayer to the Emperor himself.
They are a group which have spent countless generations designing Paul to be the freak he claims himself to be. we could argue that their devious plot has terminated his choice at finding his own life, and the Gom Jabbar test is another instrument molding him into a type of superhuman, requiring him to endure unimaginable pain so as to avoid death. But the test also instills the notion that life is nothing but pain, that suffering should always be expected and welcomed. As he endures and passes the test, images of the jihad, the holy war that will destroy humanity, appear in his vision. As he faces his own fear and pain, while accepting the suffering, images of the world's end are concurrently created. Through his acceptance of a pain-filled life of suffering, it is becoming much easier to accept visions of a holy war as a proven fact. As a reverend mother finishes her test, she asks him,
"Do you often dream things that happen just as you dream them?"
And Paul's response of "not exactly" displeases her. She desires a complete slave, someone whose visions and dreams are completely accurate, a man who is tied into their fate with no chance of escape. His answer leaves a bad taste in her mouth, as Paul still possesses the ability to divert from the laid out plans which are forming in his head. His free will is still intact. He has not lost the ability to question and think for himself, to consider alternate paths. It makes us wonder whether Paul's visions have been planted within his psyche, a way to complete the motherhood's ultimate purpose.
It's all part of a plan.
As they arrive on Arrakis, the common people are heard proclaiming Paul to be the Lisan al-Ghaib, spurning a debate between he and his mother. Jessica believes they say this because the prophecy is coming true, that the Fremen are becoming witness to this historical event, while Paul looks at it as a form of superstition, stating,
"You see what they've been told to see."
Continuing to question and think for himself, he examines the way that all people, including himself, can be conditioned to believe an idea so fervently that there is no other choice than to accept the idea as reality. He considers how the world we become accustomed to is primarily determined by the stories we have been told and the interests of the authorities in charge of those stories. Paul speaks with the man watering the date trees, learning that each tree's survival requires the water that would save the lives of 5 humans. The trees have been transported to the planet, and their production of fruit might be worth close to nothing. Despite these realities, water is given to the trees, as opposed to many poor souls. This logic is very confusing, and Paul considers if removing the trees would be helpful, before the man interjects and claims the trees to be sacred. It's as if the power and weight of that word stops the conversation. There is no way of getting past symbols that hold such power over our lives. The symbol has petrified, as it has lost its living meaning. The Fremen then says, "Old dream," and we are again confronted with the theme of dream, vision, and that which is held as holy, all of which hold sway over our lives. We are unable to contest any of it, to change the conversation regarding that which has been destined from high above. The meaning of the old dream persists in this world and our own, as one must respect what has always been respected. Paul's waking visions begin when he enters the desert and is exposed to spice, claiming afterwards that his eyes became wide open. He foresees early encounters with Chani, but the images perplex, seeing himself die to her blade while also viewing the birth of his sister. We will eventually come to see that part of the vision is true while the other half is false, further confirming that his visions and dreams are not to be trusted completely, that there is always an alternate path that can present itself. Free will is still in play, though Paul seems to be choosing which vision to trust and which one to disregard, therefore limiting his free will as he veers towards the ingrained belief, the belief that he is the one to rule the universe.
"It's coming. I see a holy war spreading across the universe like unquenchable fire. A warrior religion that waged its Hades banner in my father's name."
Paul's visions soon intensify as he goes deeper into the desert, and he is becoming haunted by the prospect of a holy war in his name. He needs help, requesting that
somebody help me, please.
He is realizing his terrible purpose, wanting to escape this fated future. He believes that he has no power to do it by himself, that his will may be incapable without outside assistance. He is beginning to buy into the idea that these visions are valid, failing to see how visions don't exist until they occur in the present, and that until then, they are just phantoms of the mind. Liette Keynes introduces Paul and his mother to the ecological testing station, and we are provided a fitting metaphor for the predicament Paul finds himself within at this time. Keynes says about the testing station,
"They were meant to tame the planet, free the water locked beneath the sands. Arrakis could have been a paradise. The work had begun, but then the spice was discovered. Suddenly, no one wanted the desert to go away."
This statement relates to the matters of the planet, but also to Paul and his need to tame his own inner war. He is needing to free himself from the binds of his tortured psyche, the one being controlled by unconscious commands, those that restrict his paths and move him towards one possible future. He is unable to find this escape as he holds on to his own desert, his own personal version of spice hoarding, which promises riches, power, and that which is most objectively valuable. He is bound to the life that others deem sacred, namely his family lineage and his personal inheritance, one that leaves Paul's personal salvation and paradise out of the equation. He is suppressing the living waters of his own essence, that which could be forever replenished in the garden of a liberated mind. Not surprisingly, this is when Paul begins to more fully accept the destiny that has been fated. He speaks about the coming of the prophet, the voice from the outer world that will lead the Fremen to the hoped-for paradise. Instead of continuing his pursuits of personal questioning, a path that could lead to an inner paradisal world, he is now desiring to lead others towards an external version of the Promised Land. The prophecy is being bought into as his philosophizing and investigation into meaning decreases. Through these decisions, he is losing the opportunity to locate an individual paradise, and in turn is becoming the one who will determine what paradise looks like to others. His inner world is reflecting his stance towards the outer world, accepting the dictates set forth upon him, just as he is taking steps towards dictatorship of others.
The mystery of life isn't a problem to solve, but a reality to experience. A process that cannot be understood by stopping it. We must move with the flow of the process.
Paul navigates the sandstorm in the Thopter. He envisions the yet-to-be-seen Jameis as a friend, guide, and helper in his future journey. Jameis's words are uplifting and objective. He urges him to stop trying to predict the future and instead relax into the mystery that unfolds around him. He wants Paul to let go and embrace the nature of the changing world. Paul soon meets Jameis in reality, and the scene in his head starkly contrasts with what actually occurs. This is not the welcoming, guiding friend who offered help to the off-world prophet. He is instead vengeful, prideful, and combative, the very opposite of what was presented in Paul's vision. We have further proof that there are multiple futures lying forth in wait for Paul and ourselves, that nothing is confirmed by dreams or visions, and that reality does not happen until we experience it. It confirms that new choices can always be made, that new routes can always be discovered, regardless of how true an idea seems to be. It suggests that we all need to stop trying to understand the future and instead flow with the process and allow ourselves to become that which comes to be. As Paul and Jameis prepare to battle, Paul sees another vision of himself dying by Jameis's blade. And again, we might wonder why Paul chose to ignore the relevance of this vision, failing to ponder upon this failed future. we can chalk it up to his confirmation bias, continuing to see and accept only that which he expects and anticipates, while dismissing all else. The visions are in actuality just mere possibilities, more proof that fantasies and dreams can run wild, while often failing to match the reality of the moment. Jameis is killed in battle, and Paul is exposed to further visions of the inevitable holy war. But we know that the future is not written in stone, that destiny can be challenged if one is only able to muster the courage and will. And so why does it seem that some of Paul's visions, like that of the holy war, are so unavoidable, while images of his death can be averted? Why is one valid while the other is not? Did he in fact have the opportunity to choose a future in which Jameis was his guide, in which he was taught to flow with the desert? A future in which pain, suffering, and war was not the only path available? Paul is slowly moving closer to a destiny of holy war. It is a path he has seen, but is also a path he has been conditioned to choose and accept. His whole life and generations of lives before him have been preparing him for these decisions, to neglect and look past other possible scenarios which might contain peace, love, and harmony, and to instead speed towards a place of destruction, suffering, fear, and pain. His lust for desert power is baked into his bones, and it is almost impossible for him to escape its clutches. The prophecy of his life is beginning to be fulfilled, as Paul fails to question his destiny, and instead becomes an instrument and consequence of the world's designs.